All right. Okay. So we go to page 86 of this book called Critical Semiotics, and I'm going through descriptions of the Android meme. Or descriptions of the postmodern world, the digital world, that we can adapt to what I mean by Android meme. So we were reading about Masquerade, and we got up to this point. So then we go over here. So page 87. With Masquerade, one might expect, so that's like with Manipian Satire. With Manipian Satire, one might expect that not only theater, but parody return. No longer left behind in an earlier order of simulation by Baudrillard, in advancing toward the hyperreal and the erasure of the distinction between the real and the imaginary. What then is the role of re-theatricalization when the real is no longer intact? Moreover, what becomes of the optimism of theatrical illusion? Hegemony is on the contrary. So hegemony is the later stage of theater. Cynical hegemony. Hegemony is on the contrary saturated with arrogance, cynicism, and hypocrisy. Any hope of critical negativity, subversion, and transgression has been dashed. Hegemony works by means of a blanket proliferation that is parodic or parody. Total masquerade. Indeed, Baudrillard also aligns masquerade with mockery. Masquerade's mockery of the liquidation of the real and liquidation of value and the liquidation of representation is for Baudrillard the principle of government in the area of hegemony. Then it's a quote by Baudrillard. The new strategy, and it truly is a mutation, is the self-immolation of value, of every system of value, unhinged by simulation of self-denial, indifferentiation, rejection, and nullity as the triumphant command. So you can see there, very cynical, very undermining every human value, which Baudrillard sees is the way tetrad managers are. Or the Android meme, I would say, is that way, appears that way. Nothing is sacred. And I have a note that Trump is predicted by Baudrillard's masquerade. At least his image looks like that. Then it says Baudrillard's... No, I want that part. Then I have a section called Veronian. All right, this is interesting. If then a Baudrillardian position on events cannot be held... This is page 88. If then a Baudrillard... I have here... Wait a minute. Let's go back here. I have here my chart and Trump. So let's see what it says. Baudrillard's interpretation of the Watergate scandal is a foundation for the application of his critique to contemporary events, namely the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. Baudrillard's diagnosis of the, quote, vicious curvature of political space, like the wingtips of the aforementioned stucco angel, but this time clad in mirrors, reveals how claims about scandals annul themselves and revert to their opposites. The idea that value self-immolates is very distant from the demarcated role of symbolic exchange. Scandal is a masquerade suited to a morality play in which it is impossible to choose between empty ideologies or between empty ideologues and their critics. The only scandal here is the effect of scandal itself in a political field completely unhinged by simulation. So that's the multiple complex levels of communication leads to even scandal isn't what it used to be. If then a Baudrillardian position on events cannot be held because it does not exist outside of the field it describes. Do that again. If then a Baudrillardian position on events cannot be held because it does not exist outside of the field it describes, namely the field in which the indistinction between poles and positions is impossible to determine, how are we to grasp his claims about hegemony and regain his conception of masquerade? Now, that was a difficult sentence. Let me try that again. If then a Baudrillardian position on events cannot be held because it does not exist outside of the field it describes. So you can't get outside of the field you're describing. You're postmodern and you don't have a position. Namely, and then here seems to be the position. the field in which the indistinction between poles and positions is impossible to determine. Where this nebulosity, tactile blurriness, it's hard to determine where that field is. And if that's the case, how are we to grasp Baudrillard's claims about hegemony and satire and regain his conception of masquerade? Masquerade is simply Baudrillard's way of underlining the cancellation of differences and the inability to isolate specific processes that rely upon some principle that would save them from indeterminacy. Masquerade is not joyous, not celebratory. Ah, see? It's not Veronian. It's Manippian. It is still, as Deleuzians might put it, indexed to degradation and loss, as opposed to the production of differentiation and the eternal return. All right, I'll leave that there. There's where Veronian comes in. The political spectacle is Manippian. Me and Ian are anti-environments. We are Veronian. So here is a description that I say reminds me of Trump. Bill Bogard imagines that simulation is fully achieved when it can neither be delivered through any identifiable medium nor framed by a technological device. Zeros and ones for as far as anyone knows. So you can't figure out what the digital device is. Bogard imagines that simulation is fully achieved when it can neither be delivered through any identifiable medium nor framed by a technological device. So when I read that, I said, that could be the uncategorizable aspect of Trump. Then it says, zeros and ones for as far as anyone knows. The surface is itself not perceptible. The surface of Trump is not perceptible. Transparency is given in advance and without windows. The medium falls away. In this way, any effort to recapture a reality, either from an idealist or realist position, must itself be simulacral. Extrapolating from this, Baudrillard insists that the spatial and perceptible conditions no longer exist in which traditional relations of force and violence can be fought. Hegemony is then not only post-political, but post-human, entailing obsolescence of human being in a non-Euclidean space, in a non-visible space, of unpredictable events. Now that's Trump. We've got a president who's not really human. we have Cha just chimed in. Why do you come so late? Because you're sleeping, Cha?
Yes, I hurt my eye. I had to rest it. I've just bathed it. I got my lens stuck. Sorry.
Oh, okay. So you can come earlier when you're healthy.
Yes, I certainly could come about 2:30 in the morning here.
Okay.
I've been trying to get onto a different sleep cycle so that I go to bed earlier, no matter what time everyone else around here goes to bed, and then I can wake up at about 2. Tonight it's easy, 12 o'clock, because that I can easily stay up till 12. Sorry, Bob, I apologize. I did enjoy the Trump, the McLuhan yesterday on the payday, though. I put a little post about a interesting link.
Yeah, what is that? What was the McLuhan on payday?
It was when you were replaying some different things and discussing things with Bert and Eliza. It was very interesting. It was
okay,
around.
We were playing actual McLuhan talk.
Yeah, no, not McLuhan Talk, discussing McLuhan and discussing a website, two websites that had quite a lot about McLuhan on them.
Oh, okay. All
That's
right.
That's for so those who listen to New Coach House. I put it on the chat so anyone could see it if they wanted to pick up an extra dimension. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut across what you were saying.
Okay,
you were saying hegemony.
Hey, don't say sorry. I don't want you saying sorry anymore, okay?
I made a mistake. Yes, I picked
yeah,
that
sorry.
Up as well.
Your last time.
Sorry,
I said sorry. That's your last time.
Yes, I heard that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry. I made a mistake.
Right. So, this is Trump. Baudrillard insists that the spatial and perceptible conditions no longer exist in which traditional force and violence can be fought. You can't even have a fucking war. They're so unboundaried. Hegemony is then not only post-political but post-human, entailing obsolescence of human being in a non-Euclidean space of unpredictable events. So then I have your Android meme. So the next thing is a description of the Android meme. So where masquerade? For Baudrillard, masquerade is a concept that retains nothing of the play of reality and its simulation once rehearsed in the hegemonic order. It is only awkwardly indexed to specific reproductive media and to material, platforms that require referential stability. So a big part of masquerade is this nothingness. It doesn't even have a dialogue going on between reality and a simulation. All right. Today, masquerade suggests the affect, not effect, the affect of global panic, of pseudo-events like bird flu scares and Y2K bugs. So those things are satires. This also includes the euphoria produced by a silent conjuration, which means our secret delight in seeing the stupidity and corruption of those in power, like Toronto's mayor, Rob Ford. But this is not new, as Baudrillard explained much earlier in his analysis of the French Socialist Party, a book called The Divine Left, when he included entertainers-turned-politicians like Yves Montan and Ronald Reagan as examples of the revenge of the people against the political class. So Trump is a more obvious revenge of the people against the political class, than including the talking heads class, too. So that's interesting, eh?
Very.
Okay. Finally, Baudrillard's later position calls into question a critical recourse to writing with neither a medium nor a message. So why does Baudrillard write is the question. What does he think he's doing when he's writing when he was just redoing Finnegan's Wake, you know, with no ostensible definition? So they go, finally, Baudrillard's later position calls into question a critical recourse to writing. Medium nor message. Writing is displaced onto blogs and content farms, and his earlier belief in poetic dispersion, pataphysical love of paralogy, New York graffiti, and the delicacy of passwords, anagrams, and anti-totalizing and anti-teleological fragments, all this can no longer find a place in a world of networks and machine-to-machine communication. There it is. Case closed, guys. You see that?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So Baudrillard's his earlier belief in this and that can no longer, so even Baudrillard can't even find a place. Oh, yeah, turn that off. We got an echo. Can no longer find a place in the world of networks and machine-to-machine communication. So what is this world? Vulgar, referentless, programmable signals. Vulgar, referentless, no reference, and programmable. Does it matter if the force of the symbolic survives in theory writing? After all, what is symbolic exchange once signs have set themselves ablaze and communication takes place beyond the code, the cultural code, I guess? This is where the gift returns with a terrible vengeance, the gift-giving aspect of society. For one accrues prestige by means of unlimited expenditure, you know, spending, destroying, by reckless destruction of one's property, in a masquerade of indifference to one's possessions. That is, a feigned interest in self-gratification, but mixed with knowledge of the creation of hardship and likely self-harm. Baudrillard's anthropological imaginary returns in the end to Bataille's valorization of expenditure against rational and utilitarian usage of goods, as self-fulfillment of the things lost. This is the non-cooptable exuberance of which Baudrillard too dreams. So it's a manipian consumption of objects with no balance about, I guess, saving food for other purposes. Just spend, and waste.
Gosh.
That's what happened to society since the 60s. What do you think of that?
It's so true. So true.
Mm-hmm. You know, the gift.
It reminds me that the French person you interviewed on Payday, who said that the when you read the word triggering, it said, and Jean picked it up as well on that chat, on that payday, it was phatic was triggering breath, which in a way it was triggering a pause. So I can see the role of phatic in this, because it seems so fast, this vulgar, preferenceless, programmable signals, communication beyond, a terrible code, spending, destroying, rebalance, spend. I mean, it's just, when did he write this, Bob?
Back in the 70s. Baudrillard started to get it in the 70s, early 80s, you know, after sort of studying McLuhan. And then his own course, he was a sociologist, and he studied a guy named Mauss, some anthropology, and made his own unique perspective on it all. Yeah, this is 70s and 80s.
Gosh.
Now,
would you say that was prescient?
Well, remember, McLuhan's saying it's a garbage apocalypse in 1969, 1970. It's like Baudrillard and those guys provide the details of what McLuhan sees. McLuhan just is shocking everybody by saying it's a garbage apocalypse. And then he doesn't have the resources or the time or whatever to start finding details. And maybe they weren't any details. But by the 80s, there's all kinds of new disillusioned information coming out that Baudrillard could see what it adds up to. So it's prescient for, what was the question? It's prescient for everybody, basically. But let's remember that McLuhan was even more prescient. It's a garbage apocalypse. I mean, it's the garbage world, or they knew what to do with it, or keep it in the incinerators, keep it in certain areas, keep it near the ghettos, you know, where there's no property values. That has an apocalypse. The garbage world has an apocalypse.
Thank you. Very interesting and helpful.
Right. And so a lot of this is, I guess, Manipian in the sense that it's encouraging you to get rid of the normal categories you think in. Your categories aren't going to work. It's way beyond the categorizable. So then you got to figure out how to think and talk in that situation.
So you're reading my mind.
I don't know. You just don't know.
Well, what Baudrillard did is he went around taking photographs. he got into photography, the nonverbal.
Mm-hmm.
So what were you going to say, Michael?
No, it's Nicholas, Bob. I said you were reading my mind because I was just thinking while you were reading that, what does the landscape look like now from your point of view, from your perspective?
My perspective?
Yeah.
No, we're broken past. I don't have... they talk about Baudrillard. He goes to America, and he likes going to desert regions in America, and because he sees the whole world as a desert. Now, I don't know how much he really did or how much is satirical or what, but he's dead, and I'm not, and I'm way older than him. And I see with Ion and our products a rejuvenation. Would these guys end up where the pagan ends up? You know, the syndical pagan, they miss something. In some way, they're still in their mind.
Yeah, and they're locked in the labyrinth of the mind.
Yeah, and they don't become Veronian. You know, the joy of the RNA drops in Remake is a Veronian effect.
Yeah.
You don't feel pissed off or depressed or cynical.
I've never felt better in my life, Bob.
Right. And so that's what I see. But I'm saying this stuff when Ion's not around to, it's like an understandable level of disappearance that Ion is talking about, but it's hard to get it from Ion. So for people like Shah or yourself who haven't, gone through this bleak, what seems to be a bleak scenario, I just want you to know that this is what they teach in university.
Gosh. So really, Ion probably would say there is no time, so that all this is collapsing. But to examine it minutely and meticulously, the way you're doing in these seminars every twice a week, is it's beginning to me. I mean, it was completely mumbo jumbo before I started listening, but now a sort of the skeleton of it is beginning to emerge with the different definitions and the way everything has been unpicked very carefully by McLuhan. It's helpful to see different definitions of him and different aspects of him from different sources, which people have mentioned on the chat and otherwise, and you've mentioned, so that it's easier to form a picture of exactly what he stood for.
What he saw.
What's the difference between the two? I don't see why they aren't the same.
Well, when you stand somewhere, you're standing there, and that has a certain view, a point of view. Mm-hmm. And McLuhan said his method was not to have a point of view. Now, you could say that's a point of view, but he was always trying to undermine it.
Like the difference between a probe and an opinion, Bob.
Yes. He was always making stuff up as close to reality as he could get. He called this pattern recognition or probing. Like, Trump in some way is an exaggeration of what McLuhan was doing.
What, so you can't exact, no journalist or media can say precisely where he's coming from. They can't predict him. They can't anticipate him. Is that
right, that's
what
where
I'm hearing?
I read. Yeah, here's where Bill Bogart imagines that simulation is fully achieved when it can neither be delivered through any identifiable medium nor framed by a technological device. So McLuhan is in that off-framed area, like Finnegan's Wake.
Oh.
Now, right. Now, I just want to mention it says here, talking about the Android meme, it's mixed with knowledge of the creation of hardship and likely self-harm. That's the song, I May Get Hurt. You know, the Charles Grodin song. I was thinking of that.
Can you play it?
we did several times. So wait a minute, I only got 40 minutes. And we can't adjust your lateness. You can hear it anytime you want.
As soon as the show's over.
Yeah, it's right at the beginning of the show. You can hear it in the archives. So you get in the old conspicuous consumption, or the handing out of gifts in a way indiscriminately, you accrue prestige by means of unlimited expenditure, by reckless destruction of one's property, in a masquerade of indifference to one's possessions. That is a feigned interest in self-gratification, but mixed with knowledge of the creation of hardship and likely self-harm. That's a good summary of the lyrics, destroying everything around you or witnessing it, and including yourself getting hurt. So I made a little note of that. Then it says Baudrillard's anthropological imaginary, so making up interesting patterns from reading anthropology, that imaginary returns in the end to Bataille, who is another writer, but way back in the 30s, who wrote about the values of excess, the excess, waste. He was sort of showing, he calls it the valorization or value, making value out of expenditure. So that Baudrillard returns in the end to Bataille's valorization of expenditure against rational and utilitarian uses of goods as self-fulfillment of the things lost. This is the non-co-optable exuberance of which Baudrillard also dreams, like Bataille. So, let's see. Here's a sentence, page 91. However, Guattari, Felix Guattari's original insight into the mutation of capital was to describe it in terms of procedures of semiotization or sign-making that went beyond monetary and financial modes by plugging into an emerging global and machinic network. So the Android meme goes beyond the banksters, the money control Illuminati. And this was Guattari's original insight into the mutation of capital, where it's described in terms of procedures of sign-making or semiotization that went beyond monetary and financial modes or signs by plugging into an emerging global and machinic network. Interesting group of words there that I can adapt to what I've been saying.
Surprising, too, that it's beyond the bankers and the Illuminati.
Right. Now, the globalization of the Android meme, it says, a theory of globalization, let's say a theory of the Android meme, before the letter developed collaboratively in the 1980s with French philosopher Eric Aliès, so he helped in the defining of money, I guess, and characterized as a stage of post-industrial capitalism. So the Android meme is characterized as a stage of post-industrial capitalism marked threefold by modes of machinic production and their integration, i.e., now how is it integrated? By means of permanent crisis, by dominant semiotic economic systems in which the market becomes transnational, i.e., global capital before the letter. Not sure what the phrase before the letter means. And a state that becomes minimal, now this is the state, the government, and a state that becomes minimal and speculative, i.e., outsourcing public services.
Can you say minimal and speculative sentence again? I didn't quite catch it.
Right. So here, threefold descriptions or modes of machinic production and their integration by permanent crisis, by dominant, that would be the constant input of news, I guess, by dominant semiotic economic systems in which the market becomes transnational, and a government that, because I think that's what he means by state, and a state or government that becomes minimal and speculative. How does it do that? It outsources public services, privatizes them, I guess, or gives them to private companies. So that keeps the government minimal and speculative. Now, the a manifesto called Integrated World Capitalism, it is akin, IWC, Integrated World Capitalism, is akin to post-industrial capitalism and hints at the emergence of the importance of immaterial labor in which human semiosis, or general intellect, is directly and immediately productive of value with minimal material mediation. Then, for example, what is this immaterial labor? It's the online activities of social media websites, which extract and exploit user data in the form of search terms, posts, likes, links, friends, groups, etc. So groups who need to come up with patterns to predict trends or something, they are studying the work that's done by the social media users to find patterns that can be used actually against the people or exploit them. Does this sound familiar to you, Jason? Did you study any of this stuff in your courses?
Bataille and Baudrillard for sure.
Do they talk about it like I'm talking about it, or do they do it simpler, your professors?
No, it's way, way simpler for sure. And, I mean, I was simpler back then too, so... I didn't talk much. I just sat at the back and listened. I didn't even take notes or anything.
Yeah, because it's 20-year-olds. They don't know the world really the way I'm talking about it. They don't know McLuhan.
Yeah.
And this is if they're reading from the books, there's a lot of complex stuff to read. So I don't imagine the professor reads those quotes. He gives us just a general, vague, actually wrong summary of what Baudrillard's doing. wrong because you can't go into the detail?
They have, like, they only have, like, the time constrictions, right? They can only go so far.
It's actually a bad form of education.
I think I remember getting the textbook, and it had, like, half of, like, maybe a paragraph on McLuhan. And then, like, I think Baudrillard got, like, a full page. But even then, like, he's...
so you don't
depth behind that if you
you don't get the Baudrillard texts, you just hear about them.
They would get us to read certain parts of his stuff, but no, not like not full books. No, it was only when I started, when I graduated, that I started like taking out his full books.
So I'm there on the radio, which is in Ryerson University, a college in Toronto. And I'm talking stuff that sounds nuts, but I'm actually describing what the kids who, if they're taking those kind of courses, are being told. But they don't go into details. They don't have the background. They don't know McLuhan. So they can't get to Baudrillard. So it's kind of empty-headed. I don't know, it's really weird the state of mind these kids get into with such a cursory, superficial examination. Unless they actually go read the books themselves. Then they're back into Jason's position or my position of, well, let's just talk about it and figure out what it means. That's all you ever have to do in education. You've got to find someone to talk to about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you don't really know something until you can explain it to someone else.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah.
And this is all sociological stuff. This is not learning how to have a job in the digital quarters of the bank or something. You know what I mean? This is the realm of generalization, maybe you could call it. Impractical stuff. You end up to be a cab driver if you specialize too much in reading Baudrillard.
I took sociology.
Right. But, and look at you. You're fucking hanging out with juvenile delinquents, right? Isn't that who you help?
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent.
But it's basically, I guess, college was designed in the 80s, 90s to get really good marks so you could get into some business, some Wall Street firm or some kind of money-making thing, and then you'd be taught how to do it, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. But you had to look like you were a brown noser, that you could follow orders and make perfect marks and show that you're purposeful, disciplined or something, and then they hired you or gave you a chance.
Mm.
Yeah, you have to play the game for sure.
Yeah.
Like, I just learned how to learn, and I was like, I didn't give a shit about grade. I would, like, challenge myself and do, like, a way harder essay. I could have done just a super easy essay and gotten a B or an A or something, but I chose something more difficult.
You were
a lesser grade.
Yeah, you're saying you learned. You mean learning in a positive, constructive, creative sense. You were there to learn.
I learned how to learn, then I was off to the races.
Well, you're on the right track by sitting in the back and listening, because I did a lot of that. I'd listen to professors that I didn't know anything about the course, just start listening to them, then be disciplined about it, keep showing up. Then you learn something.
Yeah.
Well, and most of the other kids are sitting there scribbling. They're not really listening. They're just transcribing it.
That's right.
So
I would
don't
not
really
take
soak notes. It up as much. Yeah.
That's right. I made a point of not having any interference of me just listening to the person. And I became friends with some of these professors. They found me interesting because I could talk to them after about whatever they were talking about in different ways. And no other students would even come around and talk to them. Or if they did, they'd just talk about course concerns or marks or something, or papers are late. He actually didn't get much, interesting talk.
So how would you describe the contrast between the gap between the professor and the student that I'm hearing Jason describe and you describe, Bob, where the majority of the students are just going through the motions?
Yeah,
what's the gap? What's it called?
The gap is an aura of depression in the teachers, in the students, everywhere. It's all bad scene. It's all crummy. The bad vibes, no happiness there. That's most of society.
Well, that
Bob,
is anarchy
almost,
in the classroom.
Jason? Wait a minute.
The answers aren't in the classroom. So everyone's there. They know they have to go through the motions, but they know that it's not the end goal. They're just there to go somewhere else.
They put their lives on hold. They look for little escapes here and there in the off hours, but in general, there's no fun because you're just forced to put up with this. You're like in prison for a few more years. And the professor is teaching in a prison atmosphere. It's horrible. Like I would go there for the information, but I would ignore the environment as much as possible.
Yeah, the prison system came first. The education system came second, and it was largely modeled off of. Like most schools look like a prison, and like the bells and like hallways and lots
and
of locked doors.
It's a good observation, that Jason.
Yeah, one of the chapters here is all about Foucault's figuring out how prisons came about.
Discipline and punishment or something.
Discipline and punishment.
And the Panopticon.
And Felix Guattari, who we're talking about here, he said he went into a school. I don't know if he did it often. I want to check something. Yeah. He went into school, and he said there were just rampant moods of gloom in all the schools he went into. These are young kids' schools. An atmosphere of gloom.
Yeah, I went to an elementary school, middle school last week because I started doing this group project. I go in and I talk to these kids. I get them out of math and I teach them about nutrition and healthy eating and stuff. When I first showed up for my first day, like this lady, it was during lunch hour, and this lady was just screaming at this young girl who's probably like 10 or 11 and made her go to the office and then like was just screaming at her in the office and like grabbed this piece of paper and she's like, this is the third time. And she's like pointing at this piece of paper and like shoving it in her face. It was pretty intense.
It was abuse?
Borderline. I guess she did something during lunch hour and she got in trouble. But I guess it's like the third time that she's done this. And so like she had dragged her into the office and like...
Yeah, and the teacher is all frustrated. Now the teacher has a way to get rid of her frustration.
Yeah.
In a bad mood.
But I just like the pointing at the paper and like shoving the paper in her face of like the policy or something. And I was like...
Shocking. If you look at the frustration, because I always see it from the student's point of view, but as you guys are speaking, and you said that cursory superficial examination, and the teacher has to do that all the time.
Yeah.
And Amy actually said to me, she had a paper that was marked, and she did very well, and she didn't expect to do well. And then the teacher commented to her and said to her, well, Amy, yours were actually, you didn't follow any of the rules, but yours were actually the most exciting to read. And you think if the teacher just has to tick the same box with the same answers, how boring that gets for them.
Yeah.
So that they actually would also experience some excitement with some new knowledge coming up from... Or a different perspective.
Some imagination. Imagination. Okay, so I want to move forward and read. I have here two pages marked off as Android meme, like the major description of the Android meme. And then next page, I got drama of cognition. So let's see where this goes. This is trying to explain the new immaterial labor hypothesis. More and more people are involved in immaterial labor. Computer realities and typing, I guess. So it says, so it's calling this semiocapitalism. However, semiocapitalism is an invitation to explore the semiotic material relation through the lens of labor as both intellectual and affective. Affective can be like on the level of feelings, but also marked by requirement of participation and collective cooperation. You have to work in teams and groups. You have open office spaces. And you're constantly communicating within distributed networks. And relaying information is non-negotiable. I don't know what that means, relaying information. Maybe it's like going outside of the group or something. Relaying information is non... Oh, I guess you maybe it means you just have to do it. You always
pass it on.
Yeah, pass it on, I see. Yeah, relaying information is non-negotiable. Critical responses to the immaterial labor hypothesis have ranged from the preposterous. A guy named Graver says that concept is transparently absurd. That's like the professor, your principal, Nick, telling you what you're saying is ridiculous. It's not going to happen, right?
Yeah.
So the idea that you got to start measuring this immaterial labor as some kind of paid for work, should be paid for. Responses are that it's preposterous, all the way to an acute analysis of what the polemics against it exclude. Namely, the failure to appreciate its hybridity, its hybridness, and how it draws material labor within itself. So so it goes all the way to saying, from it saying it's stupid to those guys that think this is stupid are really stupid. That's an acute analysis of what the polemics against it exclude. Namely, the failure to appreciate its hybridity and how it draws material labor within itself. Whether immaterial labor is grasped tendentiously as a tendency, and here's a quote, born out by certain technologies, financial, media, digital, and subjectivities, which, while not amounting to a quantitative majority, is in some sense the hegemonic cutting edge of capital. So whether immature labor is grasped as a tendency, in other words, it's at the leading edge of capital, or any combination of the less tangible and less important, like the immediate application of labor time. That's another guy's commentary. All that is not, is not a moot point. So whether you grasp it as a tendency, as hegemonic, it is not a moot point, but one that would wisely seek a balance with positive assessments of what immaterial production, or better, being, in quotes, being, is more and above all about. And then this is what they could be about: intellection, affects, relationships, cooperation, language, communication. So then Gnosko says, it's not my goal to repudiate the dislike of a labor so untenably deluded that it needs support. Nor to deny that a labor that results in no material goods and thus points to the generalization of the predicament of women's domestic labor, whose immaterial goods are often inseparable from their production, seems to offer no more than another confirmation of the latter's subordination. So it's not my goal to repudiate the dislike of a labor, nor deny that a labor that results seems to offer no more than another confirmation of the latter's subordination. Indeed, over almost 10 years from the publication of Empire to Commonwealth, Michael Hart and Antonio Negri, they had a big hit in the radical world 15 years ago, say. Michael Hart and Antonio Negri's presentation of the significance of immaterial labor has accumulated a number of models, where first the intangible products of immaterial labor, were modeled on effective health and entertainment sectors, and symbolic analytic services, computer and high-tech sectors. So at first it was modeled there. The most recent work more fully acknowledges the feminization of labor without gender equality as a model for how effective labor, which is required of women disproportionately on and off the job, has come to assume a central place for capitalist valorization. Today, Berardi, he's a new guy, sometimes uses semiocapitalism as a synonym for financial capitalism. A quote, financial abstraction is only the extreme manifestation of the predominance of semiosis in comparison with physical production. Financial abstraction is only the extreme manifestation of the predominance of semiosis, or sign-making, in comparison with physical production. So one way to look at all this stuff here, this immaterial label, is part, you can see Ion pointing out how there's no money and there's no work to be done when you start bringing the immaterial labor concepts that a lot of people are involved in. acknowledging that immaterial labor processes are not entirely cognitive, that may involve manual applications, and that the products of such labor may have material manifestations in autonomous objects, suffices to affirm the kind of hybridity insisted upon above. It cannot be read as mere capitulation to the necessity of corporeal material mediation. Now, I don't want to get too bogged down in this stuff and how do you follow it, but it's interesting what is being said in light of what we've experienced. So they say Hart and Negri insist that immaterial factors may outweigh the material aspects of commodities, and the labor that produces them is both corporeal and cognitive. However, if immaterial labor points to a fundamental change within post-Fordist production in which human semiosis or general intellect has become directly and immediately productive of value without any material mediation, even while remaining embodied in some manner, how is this immateriality maintained while acknowledging hybridity? In order to grasp the semiotic dimension of contemporary capitalism, then, a hybrid theory of semiosis is required. Okay, down here I have a quote. Paolo Verno says, quote, "We live in a time, the post-Fordist era, in which human nature has become an economic stake. Every aspect of human nature constitutes raw material for production."
Mm.
That's, I have AM, Android Meme does that. But when Ian talks about how nobody's not a slave today, that whole machine-to enslavement theme, this is pointing to that. We live in a time, the post-Fordist era, in which human nature has become an economic stake. Every aspect of human nature constitutes raw material for production. But you can't project the old-fashioned ideas of slaves because you're making a CD or something. You're doing not very hard physical labor. It's very immaterial, but it's still paid for time. And it sounds like economists aren't including that in their understanding of what the economy is.
Yes, but the workers know it's slavery. You know, if you have to go to an office day in, day out, year in, year out.
No, we're not talking about that. That's the old-fashioned form of slavery. This is a ecstatic form of slavery. Because you aren't working in a hard, muscular, straining job. You're just inputting data, if I understand this right.
But it still amounts to the same thing, because your time is involved. It's absolutely, you don't have any freedom. You're at the mercy of whoever's in charge of you. Like Jason said, that woman bossing the 10-year-old and shoving papers in her face.
Well, we know that, but we're trying to figure out, is Gary just saying that? I don't think so. I'm trying to point out they have some new problems of defining what's going on.
Yeah, because there's not much, there's nothing coming out, so you can be typing away. In the old days, you would be doing labor and you would see something being created. So it's a weird kind of situation.
Yep.
What, you mean it just vanishes into the blue, whatever you're doing? You don't get a satisfaction of any end result.
Yeah.
I'm questioning.
And they're trying
it.
To figure out what's material and what's not material, so there's this hybrid aspect. So he says, however, how light or indeed absent this mediation may be, and some people have insisted it takes place without the necessity of mediation or a corporeal form, remains a key point for consideration. One, the guy named Verno was one of the first to advance the view that all the traits of general intellect, including formal and informal knowledge, imagination, ethical tendencies, mentalities, and language games, function themselves as productive machines in contemporary labor and do not need to take on a mechanical body or an electronic soul. So there was that quote, and that was one of the first stabs at this, and so then Gary says, this is a refined version of immateriality. Another version takes a more applied approach and uses the competence required to enter a search team into Google as an example. No, sorry. Uses the competence required to enter a search term into Google as an example of the transformation of common intellect into network value through the page rank algorithm. Clearly, in the background of this example is an embodied user.
Yeah.
A further critical view is that of Gerald Ronick, who, in Factories of Knowledge, questions the generality of intellect, not as more machinic and more living than ever before, but whether or not it is sublated into a universal unity. If this is the case, it restricts our understanding both of the singularities and their relations within general knowledge by falling back on pre-given and pre-formed knowledge. For Raunig, this necessitates the invention of a transversal intellect that emerges in traversing the singularities of thinking, speaking, fabricating knowledge. Traversing the singularities of thinking, speaking, fabricating knowledge. Thus, the need to acknowledge the potentialities of living labor for new emergent formations, i.e. general assemblies of Occupy Wall Street and so-called organizationalist organizations. So,
Bert just typed in digital janitors.
Janitors, yeah.
That's clever.
You think we should go another hour, or have you guys had enough?
I can keep going.
You don't. We don't know.
I can
right?
do half an hour, and then I'll have to stop.
I don't know. We'll see. Hold off for Bill, whether we're going to do it or not. Give us another 5 minutes. So Berardi presents in something called The Uprising a very different version of the fate of general intellect by describing how its potency, infinitely productive, fueled the euphoric dot-com years. The disorientation of drug-fueled semio-capitalism resulted in depression and disempowerment for cognitive laborers as psychic energy was drained away in a dependency on unsustainable speed and boundless growth. This leaves general intellect looking for a body, for new ways to thwart capital. And Berardi points to WikiLeaks as a prime example of its latest innovative autonomization. This example raises more questions than it answers, however, as is obvious that Julian Assange has been isolated in a place, Embassy of Ecuador, London, from which he cannot, at the time of his writing, move yet. WikiLeaks is itself part of the abstract network of the Internet, if one doesn't dwell too much on the undisclosed locations of its servers. Lazzarato asks his readers to cast off their factoryist prejudices in order to grasp the temporality of the cycle of production that is summoned by the capitalist for the duration of a task, after which it disappears back into the networks that made it possible. That would be the temp work, I guess. Do a job for a while, the capitalist shows up, you engage it, you type for it, and then it disappears.
True.
You know, it's not leaving, abandoning a town with a factory. In order to grasp the temporality of the cycle of production that is summoned by the capitalist for the duration of a task, after which it disappears back into the networks that made it possible. Semio-capitalism seemingly carries us far from simplified industrial labor, the traditional workday, and the factory floor to the complex task undertaken at any time, seemingly any place, by cognitive laborers, according to their singular subjectivities, all yoked to increasingly mobile and extensive electronic networks of exploitation, as well as those professionals who appropriate the cognitive surplus value of designers, philosophers, engineers, and computer scientists. They appropriate
yeah.
that.
Yoked in factories in India on call centers, you know, working for the London corporations.
Right. Call centers, yeah. All of life, what may be called life skills and experiences, can be appropriated by capitalism. Yet in this now, McLuhan would say, well, it's not capitalism, it's the new digital environment, the matrix that creates this kind of lifestyle. Yet in this, for Berardi, people are erased from the space of work, and non-localizable labor can be transferred, fragmented, fractured, and finally recombined in the abstract space of the Internet. In the abstract space of the Internet. You know, Zappa had this slogan, anywhere, anytime, anything, for no reason at all. That's the way capitalism works, in a way.
Yes, but it works against the nations, and that's why President Trump says, make America great again, bring everything back to America.
Yep. Something has triggered a view beyond it now. They're not
the grassroots.
Yeah.
Fed up.
Fed up of being nowhere. And nothing.
Yeah.
You know, Ian said that the crash of the economy in 2007 was not necessarily about the subprime mortgages. It was that people saw flipping of houses and the creation of wealth, and it became meaningless. So the general mind, whatever that is, said, this is too stupid, too absurd. We've got to make meeting. We're going to stop it by crashing it. So the workers are working in this discarnate, disembodied situation. And after a few decades, they said, well, we're stopping this. This is not working out. There's something severely disadvantageous about this. So Trumpism starts. And they're already, now the new theme is Trumpism failed because of the last month, and therefore the European governments are going to go back to putting Merkel back in and the more moderate people, and the Nazis are down. So they're making, the news has to come out with patterns so fast that it becomes meaningless. And of course something else, a couple of bombs will go off over the next few weeks, a couple of fucking countries will be blown up, and they'll all be back to tribalism again. You know? The shifting of the moods is absurd and not human, not on a human scale.
Well, it's almost as if there's no ground for anybody to stand on. It's as if everything's been sliced away, so they're plucking anything out of the air, whether it's any of the ranges that you've been describing are valid in this fragmented society.
Right. I think we'll go for another hour, Bill, so let me see... okay, any sour Bob? I'll say to Bill, keep going. Okay. Yeah, he hears that. Okay, so, because I want to get more quotes in. So what you were just saying, groundless, that's what first struck me when I heard that Rai, the original separateness, had returned to the plane of essence. That's 50 years ago. McLuhan's talking about the groundless. This book is trying to describe the groundless and the temporary figures that show up. And then Ian shows up to show the original ground, that it was the only ground that ever worked.
Being what?
Being.
Mm-hmm.
Comprehensive being. Being. And yes, you go, what?
Being without the what.
making
what
Bob
use?
Rich. The ground is making Bob rich. Buy his products and buy nothing else. That's the ground. And you can be sure that Bob appreciates it and will not, abuse it.
Yes, but then that means that Bob's got the ground to stand on and nobody else
has.
That's
right. But I share it all with y'all.
At a price.
The biggest ground. I've got the biggest ground. This is driving Bert crazy. Bert's all excited. That's right, Bob. I'm on the bus headed to the playground. Great insights on school and Buchanan's literate bias a few moments ago. Yeah, he said that a while ago. Then he yells out, digital janitors. Basically, when I first read Playground, that's 2 hours ago. Now he's yelling out digital janitors 2 hours later. So he got to work safely. And everybody, see, nobody is just a janitor. You're also a king, queen. You got all these service environments working for you. And so then the workers, the people are taking turns making it happen. All of it to work. And you got to do a lot of it. So, you know, part of the week you're janitor, the other part of the week you're a queen. Or some kind of paradisical, euphoric bliss state for a few hours. No?
Yeah.
Okay, so where were
no
we
comment.
At?
No comment.
Yeah, no comment.
And queen doesn't have to mean royalty either. It could just mean sexual preference.
Yes.
or a pop group.
Yeah, that's right.
Or a pop group.
Queen for a day. What was I reading? The refined version of immateriality. We talked about, you put a search term into Google, and then you get to the PageRank algorithm. And
I'm sorry. I have to butt in here, Bob, because I just thought that you were the queen bee and we are all the workers.
Yeah, that's close. That's pretty accurate. This
Thanks,
is a modern
honey.
Way of doing management. Your worker is always right. Whatever the worker says I am, I agree. They can't get to me. You can't do anything about it. You're just defining me. I'm not in the same room as you. Modern time, the art of being ruled.
In the early stages of cognition, you used to say, you just thought it and we did it. So, I mean,
yeah.
I don't know what's changed.
Nothing.
Well, you know, Wyndham Lewis wrote the book, The Art of Being Ruled. Mine is The Art of Being a Ruler. That's what I represent, the skill of being a ruler.
Yeah.
And making friends